least 13 people are killed after an explosion occurs outside the Kabul International Airport. Three U.S. troops are injured in the blast. Canada joins Belgium, Denmark, and Poland in halting evacuations from Kabul Airport amid heightened security risks. The Russian ambassador to the UK is warning that there will be consequences if Britain violates the Russian territorial waters near Crimea again. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. On top of our news this hour is Afghanistan. The Pentagon saying an explosion has occurred outside the Kabul International Airport where evacuation efforts are going on. American officials saying that the blast appears to have been the result of a suicide bomb attack. Unnamed U.S. officials saying that several American troops have been injured, may have been injured. Meantime, the Taliban saying at least 13 people were killed, including children. The militant group says many of its guards have been wounded as well. Now, that happened after several Western countries warned about risks of an imminent terror attack in Kabul Airport, urging people to avoid the venue. Germany had also warned that departures have reached their most dangerous stage.
Right now, we are in the most hectic, the most dangerous, and the most sensitive phase. We know that the terror threats have massively increased and that they have become a lot more concrete. The foreign ministry informed the relevant people overnight that they should no longer make their way to the airport on their own.
The German defense minister described the situation around the Kabul airport as very difficult and dangerous. Canada, Poland, Belgium, and Denmark have all stopped their evacuations. Washington saying its operations will go on through the end of the month. The Taliban have refused to extend the deadline for the withdrawal of foreign troops beyond the August 31st deadline. Now let's go to the African capital, Kabul. Amin Alami, our correspondent, is watching all that's happening there. Amin, bring us up to date.
Well, Thursday evening was a deadly evening for Kabul as a huge suicide blast took place in front of the eastern gate of Kabul International Airport here in northeast of the capital. According to Taliban sources, at least 13 individuals, including women and children, were killed, and at least three other American soldiers were also wounded. Bad eyewitnesses who were close to the blast site told us that there were at least 20 people who had lost their lives, and more than 40 others were also sustained injuries. Just a few kilometers to our office, Harris Emergency Hospital for the war victims. I talked to the officials in this emergency hospital as well. They said that we have received 25 injured individuals so far, and he also said that five of them have so far been lost their lives. In the meantime, the U.S., the U.K., and the European Union had already warned about the possible terrorist attack inside and around the Kabul International Airport. That is why they had asked all of their nationals and all those who were around the Kabul International Airport to urgently leave the area, as there is the possibility of a huge terrorist attack. Just only hours after those warnings, we witnessed a huge blast there. But in the meantime, the situation is currently under the control of Taliban members who are guarding the Kabul International Airport. In the meantime, Taliban sources also confirmed that a number of the members have also sustained injuries who were in charge of protecting Kabul International Airport and who were stationed outside of this airport. In the meantime, there is no any other comment regarding to the continuation of the evacuation of foreign nationals and Afghan nationals from this key airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul. But the U.S. had already said that we are going to extend the evacuation program or the evacuation process from Kabul International Airport to other countries, a decision or a proposal that was rejected by the Taliban here, as the Taliban said that if the U.S. insist on extension of troops withdrawal beyond May 31st, it would have consequences for the U.S. troops here.
And I mean, is there any claim of responsibility for this explosion? I wonder if there is any. And who could it be?
No, there is none of terrorist groups has so far claimed responsibility regarding to this incident, despite there are at least 20 terrorist groups who are operating inside Afghanistan. But the Taliban blamed the Daesh terrorist group for launching such deadly attack on the entrance gate of eastern entrance gate of Kabul International Airport that claimed the lives of dozens of civilians and injured dozens more.
Okay, so keep a close eye on that. We may come to you at a later time. Thank you very much for that. Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul. Now, Russia says that there will be consequences if Britain violates its territorial waters again. The Russian ambassador to the UK told the BBC his country would make it more difficult for British military vessels to enter its waters next time. Andrei Killen was referring to a June intrusion by the British naval destroyer HMS Defender into Russian territorial waters in the Black Sea. The Russian Defense Ministry said at the time that it had fired warning shots at the vessel off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Moscow also slammed Britain for violating international law, denouncing the move as dangerous and provocative. Britain, however, claims that the vessel was in the Ukrainian territory in accordance with international law. The U.S. continues its aggressive stance against China. Vice President's tour of Southeast Asia resembled more an anti-China tour than any other thing. Kamala Harris made every effort to rally nations around the region against China, and this at a time when the world is witnessing U.S.'s messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. How likely is it that nations in this region of the world want a military confrontation to happen in their own backyard?
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues the tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
Now, Beijing has responded to U.S. Vice President's anti-China statements with the same veracity. It's accused Washington of refusing to join the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, while at the same time claiming to uphold the convention. It accuses the U.S. of recklessly intervening in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria under the pretext of protecting the interests of small countries.
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth, China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
Now moving on, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi says that tackling the COVID-19 pandemic and inflation are top priorities of his new government. He made a comment in the first official cabinet session attended by the ministers. He stressed the importance of the rule of law, calling on his cabinet to administer justice in different areas. The president also referred to the necessity of fighting corruption, saying that the people should feel improvements in all spheres of society. He noted that the country's new health ministry must take a different and comprehensive approach toward containing the COVID-19 pandemic. That meeting was held a day after all but one of Raisi's ministerial picks received a vote of confidence in parliament.
After 5 days of marathon debates in parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held on all but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister, with 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the president says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ibrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with parliament in its job.
Gracie now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister. And until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Israel has threatened it may have to resort to launching military action against Iran to help the U.S. negotiate a new nuclear deal with Tehran. The regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, has accused Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said that military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for nuke. Israel's chief of staff had also made a similar threat. Now that's happening as the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appear to have stalled. Iran has time and again rejected any renegotiation of the accord. Iran officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but it will make a crushing response to any likely aggression. In other news, Egypt has partially opened the Rafah border crossing with the besieged Gaza Strip. It will remain open in one direction for 3 days, and that's to allow stranded people to go back to the Palestinian territory. Egyptian goods and aid will also be allowed into the strip. Egypt closed the crossing on Monday, citing security reasons following the recent escalation of hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza. Rafah is a lifeline for people in Gaza who have been under a crippling Israeli siege since 2007. Cairo often makes unilateral decisions to close the border point under pressure by Israel. Japan has suspended the use of more than 1.6 million doses of Moderna's COVID vaccine over reports of contamination in some vials. Now that prompted several Japanese companies to cancel worker vaccinations planned for Thursday. The U.S. vaccine maker says the contamination could be due to a problem in one of the production lines at its manufacturing site in Spain. The Spanish pharma company Rovi, which bottles Moderna vaccines for markets other than the U.S., says it's investigating the issue that has appeared on a few batches bound for Japan. The decision to suspend the use of Moderna shots comes as Japan is battling its worst wave of infections driven by the Delta strain. Daily infections there exceeded 25,000 this month for the first time. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. The U.S. Refugee Act of 1980 standardized the procedures for admitting refugees, people who have fled war, violence, conflict, or persecution, and put in place a rigorous vetting process. But over the past 40 years, U.S. acceptance rates for refugees worldwide have fallen significantly, from 200,000 admitted in 1980 to less than 50,000 in 2019. We have prepared you an article written by Tazrina Sajjad, Senior Professional Lecturer of Global Governance, Politics and Security at American University School of International Service. The piece is titled, Where Will Afghanistan's Refugees Go? The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Images of thousands of Afghans desperately trying to flee their country following a hasty U.S. withdrawal have provoked an international outcry. As of 22nd of August 2021, some 6,000 U.S. occupation troops were working to evacuate U.S. military, American citizens, and Afghan citizens who are approved for special immigrant visas, or SIVs. SIVs are a special program to supposedly protect Afghans who risk their lives working for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Germany, France, and Italy, and the United Kingdom are conducting smaller evacuation efforts for their nationals and a number of Afghan citizens. The pace of these poorly planned evacuations has been slow. They're taking place amid chaos in Kabul, where crowds are being confronted by violence from members of the now ruling Taliban and U.S. occupation forces and facing checkpoints that are near impossible to pass. Shahzad Akbar, who leads the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, called the situation failure upon failure. Shahzad Akbar said, as a scholar specializing in forcible displacement and refugees, I see this harrowing scene unfolding within a broader context of Afghanistan's long-standing displacement crisis. This includes an unequal sharing of refugees between the developed world and economically disadvantaged countries. The U.S. Refugee Act of 1980 standardized the procedure for admitting refugees into the United States, people who have fled war, violence, conflict, and persecution, and put in place a rigorous vetting process. But over the past 40 years, U.S. acceptance rates for refugees worldwide have fallen significantly, from 200,000 refugees admitted in 1980 to less than 50,000 admitted in 2019. Over the past 20 years, the U.S. admitted more than 200,000 Afghan refugees, an average of roughly 1,000 per year. But during the 2020-2021 fiscal year, only 11,800 refugees from around the world settled in the United States. Among them were only 495 Afghan special immigrant visa recipients. That number seems tiny compared to the approximately 20,000 Afghans are now in the pipeline waiting for an SIV, and the additional 70,000 Afghans, including applicants and their immediate family members, who are eligible to apply. For decades, Afghans have also migrated or fled to Europe. Between 2015 and 2016, 300,000 of them arrived in the European continent. They were the second largest group of refugees and asylum seekers after Syrians. Asylum seekers are people seeking refugee status, but whose claim has yet to be evaluated. The Afghan population across the European continent remains small and unevenly distributed. Up until the Taliban takeover of Kabul in August of 2021, many Afghans were facing deportations. Germany is the largest European host of Afghan refugees, followed by Austria, France, and Sweden. For the first 3 months of 2021, about 7,000 Afghans were granted permanent or temporary legal status in the European Union. They are distributed between Greece, France, Germany, and Italy, with smaller Afghan contingents in other EU states. Australia, based on its 2016 census, has approximately 47,000 Afghans who are permanent residents, some of whom began arriving as early as 1979. Approximately another 4,200 Afghans have received temporary protected status. This still leaves an enormous number of Afghans who are displaced without a permanent home. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more than 500,000 have already been displaced by the violence so far in 2021. Some 80% of nearly 250,000 Afghan citizens forced to flee since the end of May are women and children. As of 2021 and prior to the current crisis, at least 3.5 million Afghans remain uprooted within Afghanistan itself because of violence, political unrest, poverty, climate crisis, and a lack of economic opportunity. The vast majority of Afghan refugees do not settle in the West. Pakistan, which shares a 1,640-mile land border with Afghanistan, has long absorbed the largest number of Afghan refugees, even though it is not a party to the 1951 Refugee Convention or the 1967 Protocol. Within 2 years of the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, following the resistance of the Mujahideen against occupying Soviet forces, 1.5 million Afghans had become refugees. By 1986, nearly 5 million Afghans had fled to neighboring Pakistan and Iran. Since March of 2002, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, had repatriated nearly 3.2 million Afghans, but in April of 2021, the United Nations reported that more than 1.4 million Afghan refugees remained in Pakistan due to ongoing violence, unemployment, and political turbulence in Afghanistan. The Islamic Republic of Iran also remains a significant host for Afghan refugees, with nearly 800,000 registered refugees and at least 2 million more who are unregistered. Smaller numbers of Afghan refugees and asylum seekers are in India, Indonesia, and Malaysia. India has 15,689, Indonesia 7,692, and Malaysia 2,478. Turkey, the world's largest refugee host, with more than 3.8 million registered Syrian refugees, has 980 registered Afghan refugees and 116,000 Afghan asylum seekers. The latest figures from the Associated Press show that more than 47,000 Afghan civilians and at least 66,000 Afghan military and police forces have died in the 20-year-old Afghan-Afghanistan war. The security situation in the country had been deteriorating in recent years. According to Brown University's Cost of War project, an increasing number of Afghans have been killed as a result of crossfire, improvised explosive devices, assassinations by militant and terrorist groups including the Taliban and Daesh, night raids by U.S. military and NATO forces, and U.S.-led airstrikes. Even prior to the Taliban takeover of Kabul, civilian casualties had risen by 29% in the first quarter of 2021 compared with the same period last year, 2020. A United Nations report from 26th of July this year found a 37% increase in the number of women killed and injured in Afghanistan and a 23% increase in child casualties compared with the first quarter of last year, 2020. With the Taliban takeover of Kabul, there is a growing concern for the safety of Afghanistan's women and girls, ethnic minorities, journalists, government workers, educators, and human rights activists. Many Afghans desperate to leave the country remain outside of Kabul and far from any airport. U.S. evacuations will likely end once all Americans are out of Afghanistan. A few other Western countries have committed to taking in small numbers of Afghan refugees including Canada, which has offered to take 20,000 Afghan refugees, and the United Kingdom, which has also offered to take in 20,000 Afghan refugees over a period of 5 years. Still, adoption of hardline policies and anti-refugee sentiments across much of Europe means that relatively few Afghans will find sanctuary on the European continent. Austria and Switzerland have already refused to take in large numbers of Afghans. Turkey, already straining with refugees, said it does not want to become Europe's refugee warehouse. Other countries committing to taking in Afghans temporarily in small numbers include Albania, Qatar, Costa Rica, Mexico, Chile, Ecuador, and Colombia. Uganda, which already hosts 1.5 million refugees, mainly from South Sudan, has also agreed to take in 2,000 Afghan refugees temporarily. Ultimately, most Afghans able to leave the country will do so not in an aircraft, but on foot into neighboring Pakistan and Iran. Pakistan, already strained by its own economic and political struggles, will once again likely be the largest host for the most recently displaced Afghans. But given that border crossings in the region are difficult and dangerous, the vast majority of uprooted Afghans will remain within Afghanistan's borders. Their considerable humanitarian needs, economic and political challenges, security concerns, and resistance to the Taliban will shape the next chapter of the country's history.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagir.
These monsters that have stripped every people of whatever they could from them, some of these backwards Arab rulers, backwards, worthless, they think being Arab is wearing this attire. Even that attire is given to you by the Western people. You have nothing of yourselves. This is what they want of you. Call yourself Arab, but this is how we define Arabs. Call yourself Muslim, but we want a Muslim that does not have a problem with LGBT. We want a Muslim that does not have a problem with U.S. military presence. We want a Muslim that if they say you need to pray like this, you pray like that. So when Islam stands before them, when Ashura stands against them, when Muharram stands against them, when those who hear the message of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, they're able to stand against them, what are they going to do? They're not going to accept defeat that easily. They're going to start coming and causing deviation in Muharram. They will start coming and changing what Muharram looks like. Instead of Muharram being hayhat minna dhillah, instead of Muharram being the call of Imam al-Hussein, don't be afraid, they want to make Muharram look like another parade. Muharram look like another cultural event. Muharram, others decorate with bright colors. Muharram is dark colors. Others, when they celebrate, when they commemorate, they dance. And their music is with these instruments. Muharram is a nice voice. It sounds slightly different. And then there's a dance to it they call Matam. This is what they want Muharram to look like. A Muharram that talks about everything except for what Abu Abdullah al-Hussein did. Present Abu Abdullah al-Hussein as his prayer. Yes, the prayer of Ashura is important. But the people of Umar ibn Sa'd prayed in Karbala as well. Both of them prayed. Sometimes talking about prayer is like Umar ibn Sa'd calling for prayer. It's like Yazid, if he ever did, call for prayer. Definitely Muawiyah called for prayer. It's like Muawiyah calling for prayer. It's like Muawiyah putting Qur'ans on the spears. Look like Islam, but essentially you're going against the speaking Qur'an. It looks like Muharram. It has a nawha. It has recitations. It has matam. It has a lecture. But instead of it giving the message of Imam al-Hussein to say, Hayhat minna dhilla, we will never accept the dhilla of accepting the ways of kuffar as Islam, to accept LGBT as something that's okay. Instead of that, the message is, be okay with it. The message is kindness of Imam al-Hussein. What is it supposed to serve when you talk about kindness in that way only? Never talk about Hayhat minna dhilla. The objective becomes a way of silencing Muharram. You think they won't do that? The same way Muawiyah did this. Muawiyah didn't come and say, get rid of Islam. He didn't say, forget about Islam. He said, say, go ahead, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. Still, by the time of Yazid, they're still calling, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. In the courtyard of Yazid, when Imam al-Hussein is there with the family of Imam al-Hussein, the time for Dhuhr comes, or the time of Adhan comes, to distract the people from the message of Imam Zainul Abidin, they say, call the Adhan. See, this is an example. Adhan becomes a distraction from Islam. Adhan, Allahu Akbar, is for shaitan, like in the courtyard of Yazid. Imam Zainul Abidin is lecturing people. He's seeing they're losing the crowd. This is changing to something else. A celebration is turning into a mourning ceremony. Like, let's hush him up. How can we? Oh, it's Adhan time. Start calling the Adhan. Allahu Akbar. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ. The Ali ibn Abi Talib that the Prophet said, go refer to him, follow him, he's your master. And now after his rule, people have seen him, they're drawn to him, they're attracted to him. Muawiyah says, companion of the Prophet, oh, I forget his name, Mal'un, one of the people who lived at the time of the Prophet and hurt the Prophet in his lifetime. Samura ibn Jundab. He's got an account of during the time of the Prophet what he did. Anyhow, Muawiyah goes to him. He says, I'll give you 700,000 coins to say, I heard the Prophet say this verse that says, there are those of the people who give their lives for Allah's pleasure, is Ibn Muljam. La'natullah alayh. Okay? Pay the companion of the Prophet. Say the verse that says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ فِي الْحَيَاةِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. Those who, when they speak of the dunya, their words astonish you, amaze you, mesmerize you. The way they speak of the dunya and how valueless, how worthless the dunya is. But then, وَهُوَ أَلَدُّ الْخِصَامِ. He's your worst enemy. He said, I want you to say that I heard the Prophet said, this is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Change them. Leave the name Islam, the prayer, the call to prayer, but change the meanings of the verses of the Quran, the praise of Ali ibn Abi Talib to become the praise of the killer of Ali ibn Abi Talib. The praise of Ali ibn Abi Talib be given to Ibn Muljam, and then the words praising or describing the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt being said that this is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Want to change the essence of it, keep the shape, keep the words, keep the verse, change the meaning, keep Muharram, keep the black, keep the Noha, keep the Matam going, keep the lecture going, talk about Akhlaq, but the essence, the meaning, the message, the Hayhat Minna Dhilla, the Fayasuyuv Khudini, take that out, make it a majlis that makes it give in to these powers. We need to know, brothers and sisters, any majlis that makes us feel comfortable when we see dhulm, when we see oppression, like, oh, it's just a news headline. People of Yemen, just another headline. People in Palestine, another headline. If Muharram causes us to become like that, that's not Muharram. It's not Imam al-Hussein. It's not Ashura. It's the adhan of Yazid in his courtyard. That's what it is. It's not the call for prayer. We hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us. Every year our Muharram becomes more Husayni. The Imam of our time will come with the chant, Ya Latharat al-Husayn. The Husayniyun, the ones who take this message, are going to be willing to rise with him to avenge the blood of Imam al-Husayn, not to bring to resurrect some dead tyrant, but to bring the movement of Imam al-Hussein to its final victory, which is the rule of Islam throughout the globe. This is the objective of Imam al-Hussein, and those who are Husseini, who take this message, inshallah, they're going to be able to, hopefully. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us in these difficult times with all these fitan.
Ya Hussein, ya Habib. Ya Hussein, ya Habib. Ya Hussein, ya Habib. Ya Hussein, ya Habib.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
A new report proves that the United States truly has one of the worst healthcare systems in the world. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, One Secret Prices Expose Irrational and Cruel Nature of U.S. Healthcare System. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. with hospitals across the U.S. refusing to comply with a new federal rule requiring them to disclose the prices they negotiate with health insurers. A sampling of previously secret data published recently reveals how much basic medical procedures cost the dozens of major hospitals in a project that critics of the for-profit healthcare system said reveals the severity of its dysfunction. The database of hospital rates compiled by New York Times and researchers at University of Maryland, Baltimore, details how patients are charged drastically different prices for the same medical care depending on what insurance company they use, with some procedures costing less if a patient has no insurance at all. Patients receiving an MRI at Memorial Regional Hospital in Hollywood, Florida, will be billed between $1,827 and $2,455 if they have a Cigna, Humana, or Blue Cross plan, and only $262 if they have Medicare. The data flies in the face of claims made for years by proponents of the for-profit health insurance system, including lawmakers from both parties, that insurers help individuals and employers by negotiating favorable prices for medical care. The worrying thing is that the third party you're paying to negotiate on your behalf isn't doing as well as you would on your own, Zach Cooper, a health economist at Yale, told the Times. Matt Brunick of the People's Policy Project tweeted that the report highlights how dysfunctional the for-profit system is, with pricing schemes that clearly have no relation to anything other than boosting health insurance companies' profits to the detriment of a growing number of Americans enrolled in high-deductible health plans that require them to pay high amounts out of pocket despite having coverage. Brunick tweeted, "Keep these prices in mind the next time you see a report that tries to figure out whether a particular single-payer plan's reimbursement rate would be unworkable." As the Times reported, an insurance company can have several prices for the same service at a single hospital, based on which plan was chosen at open enrollment and whether it was bought as an individual or through work. While Americans choosing health insurance plans may spend significant time painstakingly comparing deductibles, monthly premiums, and the providers who accept a certain plan, most people have no idea that they may also be picking a much worse price when they later need care, wrote Sarah Cliff and Josh Katz at the Times. The secrecy with which hospitals and insurers are still operating despite the new transparency rule has left insurers with little incentive to negotiate well on their customers' behalf, they wrote. One mother of a young patient, Caroline H. Obliger, struggled to find out how much she would have to pay for a rabies vaccine her son needed. Her Cigna plan covered $4,198 for the vaccine containing two drugs. But since she had a $3,500 deductible, she attempted to find a way of saving money. Neither the hospital she called nor her insurer would give her answers. The report proves that the United States truly has one of the worst healthcare systems in the world. tweeted Daniel Aldana Cohen, a sociology professor at Berkeley, who was one of the many observers who took note of the research on social media. Let's be clear, your health insurance company does not work for you. It works for the stockholders of that company, said Carlos Del Rio, a professor at Emory School of Medicine, adding, it is simply unsustainable how broken the system really is. Hopefully, some degree of transparency will help. While the newly publicized price data alone is unlikely to reduce healthcare costs, suggested journalist John Walker, it could intensify pressure to radically change the U.S. healthcare system and further discredit claims that the government-run or single-payer healthcare system in which patients would be charged nothing for medical care at the point of service would be unaffordable and unrealistic. Walker added, it may produce the political will for real reform. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura, April 21st, 2010? Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, is a prominent role model in history and shows the significance of a woman's presence in one of the most important events in human history. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. This was because the forces of righteousness were apparently defeated in a military fight in Karbala, but Zainab al-Kubra's behavior was the factor that turned this apparent defeat into a permanent and decisive victory. That victory was due to the role she played after the day of Ashura. That is a very important point. The event proved that women are not on the periphery of history. It proved that women can have a central role in important historical events. This has been pointed out in several places in the Holy Quran as well. But Zainab al-Kubra is a recent example and does not belong to ancient times.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana latsham.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
The story of her life is a tangible event. She played a brilliant role making the enemies, who had apparently won the battle and slain all their opponents, feel humiliated in their own base. She branded them with permanent disgrace and turned their victory into a defeat. That was what Zainab al-Kubra did. She proved that it is possible to turn feminine morality and modesty into glory and a great jihad. The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community's situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.